Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting, challenging, and innovating session of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always know we're supposed to... Oh, yes. And today, just for the record, is December 22nd.
Yes.
2018.
All day.
All day. Which is the... Was yesterday the shortest day of the year?
Yes, yesterday was the shortest day of the year, and last night was the longest night.
So this is maybe the second shortest day of the year?
Yeah, it's getting longer, though, so we're on our way to summer already.
Oh, well, that's good. Anyway, the Personal Wealth Coach, we need to disclose, is not only the name of this radio program, it is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, and the two guys here, Jeff and...
Jake.
I just decided.
Yeah, you're just trying to.
Yeah, to see if I could
mess me up.
Yeah, are the principals there and the talkers here? So there is a relationship, but we're not giving investment advice. We're giving educational and informational stuff. I like that word, and it is from sources we believe to be reliable and consistent, and that don't issue retractions. Say, whoop, we really didn't mean that. At least not very often. But we don't guarantee or warranty the information. And we're going to be expressing opinions here, and the opinions have nothing to do with the KTEM or Town Square Media. And I'm sure there's something else I'm supposed to disclose or disclaim.
Close cover before striking. That's a good one.
Close cover before striking it, but it would still be considered to be assault.
Coffee may be hot.
Yeah, coffee may be hot, right.
Yeah, there we go. Got it covered.
And the telephone number in here, if you'd like to give us a call, and today is December 22nd, where you are as well, is 254-773-1400. And you're certainly welcome to give us a call with anything that you want to talk about that has to do with the markets or economy or investing or anything of that nature.
It's this time of year. What's going on in the market right now? There's a lot of stuff to talk about.
No, it's closed today.
It is closed today. Right.
So there's just not much. There's not much going on.
Nobody
today.
Should have any curiosity about the market. Then. You're right. It should. We should all have a nice sleepy Saturday before Christmas and just forget about the market. Actually, it's pretty good advice. But
yeah, really
if you
is,
can't, man. If you can't, we can talk to you about it.
Right. Well, the stock market, at least the S&P 500 stock index, which is the one we most closely follow, ended the week, this last week before Christmas, down a little over 7% at 2416.62, and that's the lowest point of the week and the lowest point of the year, and puts it down about 10% for the year, and it is down about 17.5% since its high back in September. And that indicates we're not that far from being in a bear market. And, of course, the big question people are asking is why? And there's probably some pretty good answers to that. But before we get into those answers, there's an interesting irony here. The high it hit in September was just a tad higher than the high it hit in February, just before the tariffs were imposed. And the first tariffs that ultimately raised the price of steel in the United States by about 40%. And therein is the prime reason, at least in our opinion, that we've just seen a pretty substantial drop in the market, and the market is down for the year. Very frankly, when you throw a lot of added expense into the supply chain for American corporations, don't be too surprised if things get bumpy. And that's basically what's happened here. There's other factors that are floating around there, and probably the biggest one, and this is something that we here in the United States are not paying a lot of attention to at the moment, but we ought to, and the market major investors, institutional investors and so on, are certainly paying some attention to it, is what's coming in March. And you say, well, what's that got to do with what's happening in December? Well, they're looking out there because that's just not that far away.
Yeah, March is pretty
close,
actually.
2.5 months from now, at about the same time, several things are going to happen. First, the debt ceiling is going to rear its ugly head. And given the government shutdown that's currently underway, because of disagreements in Congress without the Democrats controlling the House of Representatives. I mean, the Republicans can't agree on what to do here. That debt ceiling looks more and more like a serious, hard, hit-the-wall government shutdown coming. The second issue that is looming over everybody's head is Brexit. Now, we don't pay a lot of attention to Brexit in the United States, but it has a lot to do with the world economy. And it is looking more and more like the United Kingdom, Britain, is going to leave, Great Britain, is going to leave the European Common Market and the European Union with no agreement, which would be really a significant blow to the world economy and to everybody in general. It won't affect our trade with England, but although technically all of our trade agreements are not with England, they are with the European Union. And since if they just go straight out, there would be a lot of trade that we can't legally do with England at that point, and they can't do with us. And they're a fairly good-sized chunk of the world economy, and it indicates a great deal of instability that they cannot make up their minds. They can't agree on something. We in the United States are having a lot of trouble agreeing on things. You throw all this stuff in there, and it starts to get pretty unpleasant. Basically, we have a series of events coming together, particularly in March, that have got people spooked because it doesn't look like the government is stable in Europe. It doesn't look like the government is stable in the United States. The president had an agreement with Congress. Congress passed a continuing resolution that he had agreed he would sign, and then he changed his mind. And that, frankly, has got a lot of people shook. And I know that it doesn't have anything to do with the economy directly or with markets, but everything I read this morning tells me that investors were shook up by the fact that we pulled out of Syria and suddenly, unannounced, with no warning, and we are pulling out of Afghanistan, and the Secretary of Defense resigned. I know that that sounds like it doesn't have anything to do with the markets.
You put it all together, and there's a series of surveys that have just come out that investors are more concerned about politics right now than they are about the economy. So politics is having a direct result on the market. And if we have a market shutdown that is, or a government shutdown that is extended, then there's greater repercussions later on.
Well, I forgot the third thing that's happening in March, and that is the 90-day truce with China runs out. And
that's a big one.
We had some statements from Navarro that he doesn't think an agreement can be reached in 90 days. And he's the primary trade representative. So we could wind up with 25% tariffs on China, all trade with Great Britain suddenly stopping, and the government shutting down and having no money to do anything with, and that could get catastrophic in a very short order. All of these things look like they may be coming in March, and if there was a sense of stability, a sense of leadership, and I don't just mean in the United States government, I'm talking about the United States government, European government, the government of Great Britain.
France is having difficulties on the governmental side. Germany's having difficulties on the governmental side. The UK just had a no confidence vote for Theresa May, which she won, but the fact that they had a no confidence vote was a big deal.
Well, actually, the vote was in her party.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But they didn't have a complete no confidence vote in the parliament, but they had one in the party.
That's
and only
how
half
it happens.
Of her own party now supports her. About a third of her party voted against her remaining as prime minister. So if there were a no confidence vote and Labor plus 30% of the conservatives voted against her.
That's not the way no confidence votes work in parliament, though. They come from your own party. And if you lose leadership in that party, there's a further vote that says whether the party coalitions stick together. And all of those are technically outside of parliament votes, but they're all being done by members of parliament. But the this is weird.
The issue is we have governmental instability that is seems to be growing exponentially. And all of these things came now. And as a result, we had a panicked sell-off at the end of last week, or the end of this week, which is a good thing in one way.
It is.
Because this is Jeff speaking, and I think Jake probably agrees with me on this.
I'll wait to agree until I hear what you have to say.
Big bear markets don't start on a wall of worry, and we have a wall of worry.
That is
and
correct.
And corrections, particularly, all market downturns end on something called capitulation. And we had some of the highest trading volume in recent history go on the stock exchanges on Friday as people were selling and bailing out and running for the exits. This is the big news, and I'll want to talk about this more later on. Based on current earnings, not future earnings, which are look to be much better next year, like 7 to 9% are the estimates for earnings growing up for corporations next year. Based on the current earnings for this year, 2018, the price-to-earnings ratio of the S&P 500 at the close on Friday was 14. Its average over the long term is 17. The market is currently undervalued by every historic
extremely
measure.
Extremely so, yeah.
And you don't have massive bear markets start on an undervalued market. Nowhere in history have we ever had that happen.
Right. What I can draw some comparisons, just two comparisons, one that compares very easily and one that doesn't. The 1987 crash happened pretty quickly. Recovery was within 3 months. It didn't take very long if people didn't get out of the market at the crash, which, you know, when there's a crash, people got out of the market. That's why there was a crash. But those that stayed in the market didn't take very long to recover. There was no great lead up of...
I thought it was like 18 months, but that's all right.
There was no great lead up of worry to that point. There was a surprise event. And that typically is how you begin a real bear market. It's a surprise event. It didn't have a huge pessimistic buildup before it. In fact, it's the opposite. People were getting more and more optimistic. So, I mean, the quotes on this subject are really, really good. A bull market climbs a wall of worry. That's a bull market. That's the good market is climbing a wall of worry. Bull markets begin on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. Look around. Even in the last 4 weeks, in the last 3 months, in the last 5 months, 6 months, have you seen euphoria? I've seen tiny pieces of euphoria when talking about individual tech companies, but I haven't seen euphoria talking about the market or about the economy. I've seen a lot of worry from Trump supporters and from Trump non-supporters. So we've got a great economy going right now. This is something you mentioned last night when we were having dinner, that you were looking at Moody's and all these headlines are out there. And we had a new piece of data that just came out this week, a great one that we talk about regularly, the leading economic indicators, the conference boards.
And they didn't even mention it. In Moody's, they didn't even mention it.
It's disappeared, even though what it's saying is really good news. It's not as good news as they've said in the past, but we've got, according to history, according to the use of these indicators in the past, we've got a pretty good long period of time between now and the next recession. 6 to 18 months is what we're looking at. And to have us reacting in the market like this says that this is a market panic based on political and low volume information.
You can, by the way, go to, if you want to check on that, probably some of the best forecasting done strictly off the numbers is from the conference boards, the conference board is what it's called. And it's an organization that officially gets the credit for declaring when a recession starts and when it doesn't start. And I don't know how that happened, but they just get the credit on Wall Street. It's the street cred. And they have something called an index of leading economic indicators. Now, the initial reports on those of the last several months had them all up, and then they changed last month's to a slight negative. But they're saying it is up a little bit this month. Now, and the point is, we need 3 months of falling leading economic indicators in a row to get a recession. A couple of times, the Conference Board's leading economic indicators, LEI, have forecast recessions that didn't come, but they've never missed calling a recession at least 6 months before it came. And right now, we just got a positive reading off the leading economic indicators. Now, it's not a strong positive. It's up, 0.2, which isn't much, but it's up. And the coincident indicators are 0.1, which is not much, but it's up. The big one is the lagging economic indicators are up a lot. Now, that means something that we've seen going on in the economy. I mean, it's just all over. This economy is running off of what's happened in the past, but it's got a lot of momentum. And there's a lot of things that could go wrong in the future, and that's what the market is reacting to, but it's not reacting to anything that's wrong that we can say this is either happening or for sure going to happen. It's definitely worry that's driving the market down, and major bear markets do not start on worry.
Now, even if I'm going to go back to this example we were using, it doesn't match up exactly, but it's a really good basis for comparison. Black Monday in 1987, the S&P 500 lost 20.4%. That was a big drop, 20% in a single day. It's not possible for that to happen anymore because the circuit boards kick in. The circuit breakers kick in at the stock exchange and they shut down trading. And they say, all right, let's look at this again tomorrow. Because the next day, the market was up 300 points on that one. But here's the thing. If you invested $1,000 at the close of market on Black Monday, so on Tuesday, and reinvested the dividends, $1,000, if you could, and you can't really invest in the S&P 500. There are matching funds, but they didn't exist at the time. So keep that in mind. This is a comparison that could not have actually happened. But if you did buy everything in the S&P 500 with $1,000, again, not possible, you would have wound up 20 years later with $10,800. And that includes fees for trading and all of the other things. However, if you invested the day after the crash, or the day before the crash, even better. So that was the day after the crash. The day before the crash, you would have lost 30% of your investment in the next several days. But if you'd held on, you would have gained 462% over the next 20 years. So the important fact here is that crashes happen. And I don't know, I wish I could use an underline while speaking on the air and put it in bold. And this is something we say in up markets, and we say it regularly in up markets. The down markets happen. Crashes happen. And when you look at the fundamentals of our economy and of the companies involved in the stock market, as you just said, we're really underpriced right now. So if you've been sitting on cash going, I wish I could have invested 4 years ago or 3 years ago or even last year.
Well, you're at the price earning, the price earnings ratio on the S&P 500 right now is the same as it was in 2013.
Yeah.
And that means, we're not recommending that you invest in the S&P 500. Don't misunderstand. This is educational. But if a person wanted to roll the clock back, this would be the time to do it. John Templeton is, and I'm going to misquote him slightly here because I don't remember the exact words he used. But basically, he said, and John Templeton, for those of you who don't remember him, was one of, if not the most successful investor of the 20th century. And he said, when everybody, you need to accommodate the people in the market. And when they all want to sell, you should be buying. And when they all want to buy, you should be selling.
Right. John Templeton, what he said is, I believe in being a conscientious investor. When everyone wishes to buy, I oblige them and I sell. And when everyone wishes to sell, I oblige them and I buy.
And so we have a telephone call. We have a caller on 773-1400. Welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. You're on the air.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. I got two questions. What percentage of the trades are individual investors versus, you know, what I always hear is institutional investors? And when the big institutional investors have their computerized trades, do they get charged commissions like the small guy? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
There's a very complex answer to that simple question.
Yes. The question is difficult to answer unless you understand a couple of things. The first thing to understand is that institutional investors represent individual investors. A lot of the institutional investors are fund managers for 401ks, and the individuals in there own the shares in the institutional investment, which is buying the other stuff. But it's about 80% at this point institutional.
I think what you're actually trying to refer to is the computerized trading, the high-speed computerized trading, which, by the way, is prevalent. It's also important to remember that you can't set a specific percentage on that. What happens is markets move on the margin. In other words, if there's a million people who own shares, just to use a hypothetical number, but only five of them are trading today, those five will move the market because it's based on the buy and sell. It's not based on what a million people think their stock is worth. So on low volume days, which we had some of recently, the market started off relatively slow, particularly on the day when we had a Federal Reserve board member say that the market was going to pay attention to the Federal Reserve was going to pay attention to the markets, and the market suddenly shot up, and then it turned around and shot back down again. That was almost all computerized trading. The problem happens not that the computerized trading is such a huge quantity of the trades that go on, but once the computerized trading kicks in and the market starts down, a bunch of individuals and, to some degree, I think institutions, but mostly individuals, panic and charge with it because they say, oh, the market's going down, I'm going to sell. And by the way, a lot of the movement in the market right now is individuals doing
right.
it.
And this is the key. This is the thing. This is goes back to what I said. An important thing to understand here is that those institutional investors don't have complete power in their decision-making process. If those funds, what is an institutional investor? But this is for the rest of you, that what is an institution? A company. A mutual fund, a 401k, a pension, these are all considered institutional investors. If they're managing money for someone's retirement pension or for a 401k, a mutual fund is an institutional investor. There's also the venture capital. And the important part that I'm trying to get to here is that if an individual is watching the market or watching politics right now, and they go to their 401k and they readjust their 401k, they have just sold inside the institution. Now, the institution has to provide them with the money because it's transferring to another institution internally. Most of the stuff, the individual investor doesn't see it all. They're just saying, I'm taking it from this fund and putting it in that fund. Well, it's not money. And a lot of times those institutional investors will have cash in their portfolio so that when people go and sell from their position, they don't actually have to sell any of their stocks, any of their bonds, because they bought them for a reason and they would like to sell them when they want to sell them, not when the individual investors do. But if enough individuals sell, then the mutual fund manager has to start selling things he doesn't want to sell or she doesn't want to sell. And that causes the market to drop again. So there's not really a buffer by saying institutional or individual. They do get a slightly better trading expense ratio in that, in most cases, not always, in most cases, because they trade in large volume.
Yeah, and depends on what you're paying to trade on the market, but they're not paying $8 a trade.
Yeah.
They're paying pennies a trade.
It might be like saying
fractions of a penny a trade.
It might be like saying, does Walmart get a discount on toothpaste over an individual buyer? Well, yes, because they buy in large bulk, and that's why they can sell it to you. And when you think of an institution, call it E-Trade, TD Ameritrade, any of the institutions, they are charging their investors a greater amount than it costs them to do the trade, or they wouldn't be able to stay in business.
And it's important, and Jake mentioned this, but I want to emphasize it again. A lot of the selling that's been going on, and some of the market moving selling that's been going on, is simply because people are going to their pension funds, or they're going to their 401k, and they're moving from their S&P 500 index fund to something else. The biggest outflow, and I don't have solid statistical analysis on this, but right now the cash flows that I saw reported anecdotally said that S&P 500 index funds saw in the last couple of days some of the biggest liquidations in their history. And so when individual investors get scared who have been riding a 9-year bull market, and they decide to get out on Friday or Thursday, they call, they say they put the trade in on Thursday, it would hit on Friday, and that's a lot of what happened. And we may see a big drop on Monday simply because a lot of people on Friday put in their orders to move out of their S&P 500 index fund.
Yeah, and what I'm looking at, I just pulled up last week's data because it hasn't come out for the – it comes out on the 19th for the 12th. So we're looking back a week still.
Right.
But for the last 5 weeks, we've had outflows from across the market. The net outflow from bonds is negative. The net outflows from stocks is negative, whether it's worldwide or domestic.
The net outflow is positive.
Positive, yes. Yeah. So outflow, there's a lot of money coming out of the market.
Yeah. And that's individual investors selling.
Yeah, and in the commodities market, we're seeing some buying going on as represented in some people are going to gold. But one of the issues here is that, as I've said before, we were just talking about institutional investing. Institutional investors own about 80% of the S&P 500 stocks. We, as Americans, own 1/16 of gold demand. And almost none of the supply. So when we're talking about 1/16, that's a tiny fraction, a very small fraction of gold demand. There has been and have been people on television saying buy gold right now. I don't agree because it's still getting easier to get the gold. And the long-term trend on gold is downward. Just like I'm not recommending to go out and buy oil, even though oil is really, really low right now. If you go and buy it, it's going to be, you better be good at arbitrage. You better be good at finding a buyer later, because you can't really trust the exchanges to get you the best deal right now. We've got so much oil on the market, so much gold on the market. The price has been dropping consistently for a long period of time in gold, and it started back up now because there are some people that still believe in a down market you should go to gold. And the reality is that works unless the Indians and the Chinese also are having a down market at the same time, because when they need cash, they'll sell their gold. And that's a big thing that people aren't recognizing. Even Cramer, the great voice out there that we disagree with on so many things, he's recommending to buy gold right now. And you better get into day trading if you're going to be selling gold like that, because finding their best deal to sell gold means you've got to scrutinize it regularly. Where the rest of the market, you can, particularly if there's good profits, if you're buying at a good price-to-earnings ratio, you're well-diversified, you can sit back and recognize that eventually everybody else is going to know that what you hold is worth something. And so that's my statement on the commodity side.
The market, to give you some idea about, since gold is the subject here.
Yeah.
Gold dropped in price on Friday as the market fell. And that obviously isn't a very pleasant thing for people who, if there indeed is a was a movement going from gold, from the market to gold, it would not have done it. It opened lower and just continued to go lower all day as people apparently someplace were selling gold. You know, for 5 days, gold was up 1.35%, but it was down about 0.8% on Friday alone. Year to date, the market's down about 10, gold's down about 6. So the fall of the market certainly did not support a move to gold. As a matter of fact, in the 2008-2009 market contraction, panic, whatever that was,
gold fell.
Gold fell because the main buyers and sellers of gold are now in India and China. And as there is the, if we do get a recession from this, which I don't think we're going to, I think the recession is probably in 2020, then what we'll see is the Indians and the Chinese selling gold, which means that gold, and this is what's happened over the last, basically over the last decade, and we missed this, or more than decade, more last 15 years, gold tends to move not against stocks, but with stocks. In other words, gold is just another place where people put money, and when they lose faith or when they need some money because their other money is going away, they sell gold. And that wasn't true when gold prices were controlled largely by market activity in the United States. But it isn't; they aren't controlled by that. The biggest mover is market activity in India. And in India, they don't trust the banks, so they put their money in gold jewelry, and they tend to sell the gold jewelry in bad times and buy it in good times. So gold is no longer a contraindicator. It is basically going to follow the economy.
And just to kind of wrap up this subject, what does gold do? Why should it be worth more in the future? And those are questions you should ask whenever you're purchasing something. I'm going to hit a couple of pieces of technology that have come out that are being developed by corporations. There's a new fluoride battery that's in development by a series of different companies that has a lifespan on the battery and the power density on the battery that's better than lithium.
So I should invest in toothpaste?
Right. Yes. Get
it.
The fluoride in. No, that's it is fluoride, but the whitening is not the property that you're going to be looking for.
But
here.
I mean, toothpaste has fluoride in it, and I could hoard toothpaste.
Right. It will keep the cavities away, keep your bones strong, and power your computer.
But I can sell it
and your car
to the battery companies. I can sell my Crest toothpaste to the battery companies.
I don't think they're going to be buying it. It's just. But the point here is that technology is continuing. Innovation is continuing. We've got some on the cancer front, the research in fighting cancer. There have been so many breakthroughs this year on different methods, lots of different methods of effectively fighting cancer. There have been breakthroughs this year on effectively fighting Alzheimer's disease. There are a series of things that are happening innovation-wise that allow me to continue to look ahead and be greatly optimistic for the future. And it's funny because people have all year been saying that the two of us have been ultra-pessimistic. We get a good market downturn and now suddenly we're optimists.
Well, it's really simple. The market... Normally, in a big market downturn like the one we had in 2000 through 2002, or even the one we had in that began in 2007, it takes months for the market in a downturn like this to cross the point where stocks prices look reasonable, because they start at point they start way where stocks are outrageously priced. And the fangs in general are now in bear market territory.
Right. Those of you that don't know what he's talking about when he says fangs, he's not talking about the teeth of a dog. He's talking about the tech stock.
Right.
They've changed the names of the stocks inside the fangs enough. It's Facebook, Apple,
Alphabet,
Netflix. It used to be Google. Which is why, because it's now Alphabet, so you got two A's, and now it's just Fonz. But
it's Fonzie.
Fonz, but it's very much like. Do you remember a few years ago there was an acronym for buying in emerging markets?
Brick.
Brick. Yes, Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Yep, that was it.
And think of what's happened now. So when people start making acronyms, that's the beginning of an end to a bull.
Well, those high-flying stocks that had price multiples that were dizzying, that's the nicest thing I can say about them, are now, in many cases, back down in reasonable territory. Not completely, but they're back down. So the excesses of this market are gone. And that doesn't mean that Monday won't open down. Because, like I said,
it doesn't mean that we won't close the year down.
Right.
But it means we've switched from being pessimistic to looking around going, we're pretty optimistic right now.
The reason is there's a lag, and the lag is caused by mutual funds, and there's a lot of mutual fund investors out there who sold their shares or put in an order to sell their shares on Friday, but that won't hit until Monday.
Right.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yep. Scared them away.
Yeah, well, you know.
You're just so scary. We've got to play some commercials anyway. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join.
We got another call.
Before we go, we'll put somebody on the air.
All right. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Boy, that person is determined not to speak to us.
Right. So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you would like to join us, the phone number to reach us in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We've got about
13 minutes, 12 minutes, something left in the hour.
Yeah, something like that. And left in this hour, and of course, we got the second hour, too. And you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400 to talk about anything, too, that has to do with investing or the economy or that ilk.
I have a complete subject change, if you don't mind.
Okay.
There are a series of data gatherers, including Airbnb, but that, as you'll hear, you never trust the source of information if it's in their own benefit. Just ask the cigarette companies on all of their "it's safe forever" type stuff when they had stuff in the background. But there have been a series of data gathered on rents in locations before and after regulating Airbnb. So those of you that don't know what Airbnb is, it's Airbnb and all other types of sort of online timesharing of your house. So Airbnb is used quite often if somebody's got a house and they want to rent it out for a couple of weeks or a weekend or whatever, they go through Airbnb and do it. A lot of local municipalities have been very upset by this because the hotel motel tax hasn't been paid through the system. The hotels and the motels are not happy because people are not staying in their facilities. They're staying in these Airbnbs and they're not having to pay the taxes. So the cities are getting less revenue. It's very much like Uber and Lyft and the rest and the taxi driver fight. They're at each other's throat. Well, the data's come back and the municipalities that have regulated Airbnb into near non-existence have had their property values drop a lot faster than neighboring municipalities that have not over-regulated Airbnb. The rent prices have dropped drastically at a time when rent is going up across the nation. So if you are a landlord and you have some houses and you are upset because Airbnb is out there, then you need to change your opinion, because Airbnb causes people to want to move to the municipality that they're staying in, which causes the price of the housing to go up. When that happens, it needs to be considered almost like marketing for your real estate. If somebody has a good Airbnb going and people are friendly to the people that go and stay in those facilities, they want to come back. And they will bring their money with them when they come back. When almost by definition, when someone's staying in an Airbnb, they have a lot of money that they're bringing with them to spend wherever they are. So this is one of those areas where over-regulation at the local level is not only stifling innovation, but also stifling something that has been around since the beginning of ownership, the ability for someone to board a renter in their home or board a renter in their guest house. And in many cases, that's not allowed to happen anymore, which is fascinating to me that it required a new way of doing it for them to outlaw all ways of doing it, which is not always. It's a little hyperbole. A lot of ways of doing it. And that was my subject change.
That was a good subject change. Hey, by the way, to change the subject again.
Okay. All right. We can change the subject a second time.
Oil, West Texas Intermediate oil down around $45, which puts it down in the vicinity of maybe we ought not to drill so many holes in the ground. Pricing.
It is now below the profitable level even in the fracking area of Texas. So people are going to be pulling out less oil.
So why is it down at this point? And earlier the speculation as to why it was down focused around excessive supply, meaning the OPEC countries were pumping a lot of oil and we're pumping a lot of oil and it looks
Russia
like
and Venezuela.
But the OPEC countries just announced a cutback, and in fact, they started doing their cutback, and we have started slowing down the train a little bit on this end. But we still had this we had a very significant drop in the price of oil over the last. Well, it's down 40% from October, and so the question is why? And the answer,
In October it was right almost at $75 a barrel, and now it's down to $45 a barrel.
There's a really good reason for that, and that is the same problems that are worrying the stock market, because oil is purchased in advance. So oil prices, the spot price on oil is not what drives the train. It's the futures price on oil when they buy it in advance for delivery 2-3 months from now.
And the number we're quoting right now with these prices is February's futures.
And again, the issue is, primarily, the number one issue, and a lot of people have asked me, what's the big deal? And the big deal is very simply, there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of thought about what happens if in March the president imposes 25% tariffs on just about everything coming out of China. And in the past, they said, well, this will be minor, this will be. But a lot of thought has gone into this. And if we presume that China hits us with counter tariffs,
which they say they're going to if we do.
Which it would have a dramatic effect on corporate earnings. It will have a dramatic effect on the economy. The fear, the market is behaving as though there is a recession on the horizon that has already been predicted by the leading economic indicators. It hasn't.
It hasn't. There isn't one.
Could we get a recession in March? Could we get a recession kicked off in March? Yes.
Absolutely.
If the president imposes the 20, and this is just my opinion, this is Jeff speaking here, and I don't claim expertise. There is a lot of evidence. I've got some experience, but I don't claim to know the future. But I can tell you that there's a lot of evidence that companies have put the pencil to what happens if the tariffs are imposed. And the answer is either prices go up more than 25% in, for example, Walmart. Many of the listeners shop at Walmart. I shop at Walmart sometimes. And Target and everywhere else, the prices of everything in there goes up, let's say, 30%. I'll be conservative here. Steel went up 40, but let's just say it goes up 30%.
Steel went up 50.
And that will cause two things to happen. First, it's very inflationary. We suddenly got if consumer buying is 70% of our economy, and if half of the consumer purchases that they make each month are involved with something that comes out of China, and I'm just using a hypothetical string of things that could happen, then that's what causes people to worry. And we saw a 30% rise in half. That means that your cost of living, of paying for things other than your house and your utilities and so on, suddenly jumped 15%. Well, if only half of that gets translated back into the consumer price index, we would suddenly have a 7% drop, or 7% increase in the CPI in March.
That's inflation.
Now, that inflation is something that the Federal Reserve is determined to head off, and they will be forced to raise interest rates significantly in March to offset this rise in cost of doing things. The other thing that would happen, and it'll happen at the same time if it would occur, is if the price of everything in Walmart goes up 30%, you're not going to buy as much stuff from Walmart. I'm not going to buy as much stuff from wherever I from Amazon or wherever if the price of everything suddenly jumps that much, because the price, for example, of new PVC pipe, let's just presume PVC pipe comes from China, and plumbers are doing business and their PVC price jumps 30%, they will also raise their price. So across the board, we will see this mushrooming of price increases. We will see a sudden jump in interest rates to offset the inflation, and that is a good way to kick this relatively fragile economy. I say relatively, I shouldn't say it's fragile. The economy has got a lot of strength, but it's at a peak. There's every indication out there. Durable goods orders went up slightly, but if you pull out military aircraft durable good orders, it went down a little bit. And we've seen the durable goods orders, commercial durable goods orders by factories and companies and so on, slowly slipping. It doesn't indicate they're about to fall off a cliff. It just means we're somewhere near the peak in this economic cycle. What does it take to turn it around and head off in the other direction? A panic. And a sudden increase in price of 25 or 30% on all that stuff means buying would suddenly grind to a halt. And that could trigger a recession. Do I think it's going to trigger a recession? Well, based on history, no. Why? Because, again, the leading economic indicators don't tell us a recession is coming. And I think the president would like to get reelected, so I don't think he's going to impose tariffs that would throw the economy into a recession. But it's possible. It's one of those things to put on the plate. Now, if he did, I kind of strongly suspect that he'd take it back. Because I think the firestorm among the people who support him, when the price of everything they normally buy suddenly jumps 30%, would be sufficient to change his mind. But that's all speculation about the future, but it gives you some understanding of why people are selling, other than the fact they're selling because the market went down. And
right.
I think Friday, we may have seen what's known as capitulation, which means the people who are selling because everybody else is selling, you've got that worked out. And once that stops, I think the market will turn around. And by the way, Barron's is calling for a 10% rise in the market next year.
Yeah, the big questions, and we're about out of time for this hour, but the big question is, how long will the government shutdown last? Will the trade war continue with truce or actually go into war? There's a lot that's unknown, which makes anybody's crystal ball always be opaque. But at this point, it's very hard to predict anything. But we are about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, hopefully driving your brains into
a frenzy of foolishness. No,
no. No. Some kind of insanity. I mean, sanity, maybe something. We'll have fun next hour. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we do give personalized custom advice to people of high net worth. Our local number is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that line toll-free, 1-800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts from prior episodes and read our newsletters, get signed up for our new newsletters, and contact us there. We do take emails as well, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We read those, and it's great fodder. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.